There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
A very good evening. You are listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap with me, Richard Dean. Coming up this hour, we kick off this week's special report on the future of tourism, how everything from Airbnb to Generation Z are transforming travel. Plus, we're asking, is the United States headed for a recession? And if so, what could it mean for us here in the UAE? All that to come. But first, tourism expert Chris Lund of Colliers. We spoke to him and asked him to share the three game-changing megatrends that are revolutionising the travel industry. We're going to begin, you say, the top game-changing megatrend is the vacation home business, or Airbnb, if you like. Tell us about this trend and why you think it's so important.
I think, first of all, it's important to note that it's not a new game-changing trend. It's been around since 2008, but it's relatively new in Dubai because it was licensed and approved since 2016. So it's really getting the effect now, starting in 2017 and 18 and 19 this year as well. And it's evolving as well. There's a lot of new trends within the holiday home market. Hotel operators are getting into it. So, for example, Accor, they have the One Fine Stay. Marriott, they just came out with the new company called Homes and Villas by Marriott International, which they are saying will mainly focus on two-bedroom apartments and villas and above. So it will not directly initially compete with hotel rooms specifically. And then they are always adding different experiences and layers to these companies. So Airbnb, for example, initially was just a simple platform. Anyone could put any apartment, villa on there. Now they are segregating it. So they have Airbnb Plus in certain cities for more upmarket, upscale houses. Now they've come up with Airbnb experiences, so you can book a local tour guide, you can do a culinary tour where you're staying, and you know, there's rumors that they're getting into the flight business as well, where you can book your flight on the system of Airbnb as well. So it seems like it's becoming all about controlling the entire trip. So whether it is Airbnb or the hotel operators themselves, they want to get more and more involved in all aspects of the guests' stay in the hotel and out of the hotel as well.
We've had a steady stream of hoteliers on the Business Breakfast and other media who've said, well, Airbnb doesn't really compete with us. Brandy, this is one of your pet
bug
hates
bears.
And bugbears, isn't it?
Absolutely. Everyone we ask, what's the impact? You know, have you felt an impact of Airbnb? What are you doing to sort of counter it, have said, oh, no. Airbnb, it's a different market, different type of people stay at Airbnb as hotel. To which I say very roundly, codswallop, I've just been in Australia for a month. I didn't stay in a single conventional hotel. If I wasn't staying with friends, I was in an Airbnb.
Mm. So I think, you know, probably a professional would not be the right person to ask this question. The right person to ask would be the normal person on the street. You know, would you stay in an Airbnb as well as a hotel room? Do they compete? And I think, yes, they do compete. Are they the same? No, they're not the same. They are different in certain ways. Obviously, Airbnb in terms of an asset is very flexible because you can pull it on off the market. A hotel room is a hotel room every night of the day. It is for sale every single night.
Other than setting up their own businesses or buying businesses such as One Fine Stay that other people have set up to sort of buy into the market, what else can hotels do to get us in hotels rather than on peer-to-peer lending platforms?
I think this is now perhaps then touching on the next subject about loyalty programs, because this is where especially Marriott and Accor recently have come out with brand new loyalty programs. So Marriott with the Bonvoy and Accor with the All, Accor Live Limitless. And basically with these loyalty programs, they are expanding beyond the hotel experience itself, and you can get points through concerts and food tours, and you can bid on concert tickets and all kinds of different things, car rentals, etc. So they're trying to expand that. And again, it's about controlling that entire journey of the guest. So you have that guest in your program or in your reach throughout the entire stay.
I mean, if I look at the amount of adverts for the new Marriott rewards program that I'm being bombarded with, the Bonvoy, either in various, when I'm searching the internet, it comes up in my social media and various websites, watching sport, as I do quite often, loads of adverts there. They're clearly spending an absolute fortune on marketing this thing. I know, again, we mentioned Arne Sorensen for the second time today, the president of Marriott Worldwide, when he was here in the studio about 9 months ago. And he said one of the biggest challenges he's had over the past 2 or 3 years was managing the merger of Starwood and Marriott in terms of the loyalty program. I mean, it took 2 years or 2.5 years just from an IT perspective, but it is so important to them that they will invest millions, if not billions, in these things. Are they really that important to hotel chains? Do they really generate that much business?
They do. They are very, very important. And as you're saying, they are investing hundreds of millions, if not billions, of dollars into these programs in terms of marketing and the partnerships, etc. They do bring about 30 to 50% of the guests into the hotels, depending on the region. Obviously, traditionally, the US has been stronger for loyalty program customers than the Middle East, so it's a little bit less important in the Middle East.
Why is that, do you think?
I think because traditionally in the US you had a very traditional corporate market, while the Middle East has been a very fast transforming market with new hotels. So if you are stuck with one chain and you go to a new market, there's not necessarily a hotel in the location you want to stay of that particular brand. So
That so surprises me, because we take the Emirates loyalty system so personally. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you want to get emotions running high on the business breakfast, you just start talking about Skywards miles because people feel they have an ownership of it. Also, we like to get a bargain here. We like to feel that we're getting a discount or we're getting something for free. So I'm amazed that we don't take the hotel points more seriously.
I think it might come more and more as we see the markets getting more and more mature as well in the region.
What about the local players? The two I'm thinking of in particular from Dubai hotel chains are Sirius from Jumeirah, which is very well established. You by MR, which is the MR loyalty program for their brands such as Address Hotels and others. Can they make a meaningful impact? They're so much smaller than a Marriott or a Hilton. Can they really make a dent?
I think it's very different type of business. You can't really compare it to the Marriott and the Accors in terms of loyalty program, because it's very niche. It's mainly for tourists. They will use it a few times, perhaps, when they stay for a week or 2 weeks in a Jumeirah resort. They will get a lot of points because it's not cheap to stay in a luxury resort. So with those points, of course, they might be incentivized to come back to that resort or another resort. But it's not the kind of loyalty program that you will use wherever you go, because obviously the reach of those brands is still much smaller.
The third and final of the game-changing mega trends that you've identified are what you call the rapid growth of new age budget hotel chains, mainly happening in Asia. Tell us what you're talking about, and then we'll get into why it's important.
Yeah, so the examples are the likes of Oyo, Tribo, Fab Hotels, Red Doors. And these chains, you know, they are 3 to 6 years old only. And in those few years, they have about, you know, between 500 hotels, 1,000 hotels, and Oyo, which is the largest, 23,000 hotels in their portfolio. So it is basically the fastest growing company in the world in terms of hospitality, and it's the third largest hotel chain in the world. And they recently, now in 2019, in February, they came to Saudi Arabia, so they're in the Middle East as well, especially Oyo. And obviously they're backed by a lot of, you know, big investors, including Airbnb is an investor in Oyo. Oyo, they do all sorts of business. And I think this is probably part of the success of Oyo, is the flexibility that they've had compared to the traditional hospitality companies, because Oyo can do full management, they can just do a licensing deal, they can just give you the software, and they have vacation homes as well on their platform. So it's a little bit of everything, and I think that flexibility has made it very easy for them to take on all these unbranded 2-star, 1-star, 3-star properties.
We're going to have to leave it there. Fascinating discussion. Christopher Lund is Head of Hotels for the Middle East and North Africa region at Colliers International. Appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
A very good evening. You are listening to The Business Breakfast Nightcap with me, Richard Dean.
We have a special focus on the business of tourism this week and your tourism business now, because we are speaking to Reem Al-Khatib, who's the Managing Director of Guest Ready, which is a management services firm for Airbnb and other peer-to-peer lending properties. Reem, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Do you want to give us the elevator pitch and tell us, if you've got an apartment that you want to let out on Airbnb, what would you do for us?
So if you have an apartment here in Dubai, we first come in and inspect the property, and then we let you know if we think it would do better on a short-term basis compared to a long-term basis. And then we also add, if we do think that there's potential there, we go in and we add our final touches. We try to make the property a little bit more attractive. We want the property to be unique and different, so we come in and we want to give, you know, all these guests a different experience when they come to Dubai. So what we would do is take care of your property and manage everything from A to Z. This includes if you would require furnishing, then there's like maintenance. It's really everything, including. Guest communication and, you know, just taking care of your property while you're abroad as well.
So you'd sort out the guests, let them in, have someone change the sheets after they've gone, turn it around for the next one.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
You mentioned there that you assess whether or not a property would be better financially as a short-term let or a long-term let. What's the defining specifics for those? What makes something better short-term rather than long-term?
So there are several factors that make a property better short-term compared to long-term. We would say the first one would be location. So all the properties are located in prime locations in Dubai. There are about 5 to 7 locations that are considered prime. Then there's also the view from the property. That's a really important factor, especially with the increased competition. There's a lot of properties out there. We want to make sure that your property is still going to be one of the top properties. Another factor is furnishing. So a property has to feel unique. It has to feel like, you know, it's home away from home, comfortable, inviting, and we know how to, you know, take care of that. So these are just the top three, you know, factors that go in.
And what kind of yield are your clients getting in Dubai at the moment?
So for yield, it's about 8 to 10%. That's the yield that we're getting now. It used to be around 10 to 12% a few years ago. And now, because there's a lot of supply, it's gone down from to 8 to 10%, which is still a really high yield compared to long term.
And what do you take as a cut for the services?
Our cut depends on, you know, the property and depends on how many properties you give us as well. It's around 20% on average.
There's a lot of competition in your space now, managing Airbnb rentals. We've had the guys from Frank Porter in. There are others as well. Within your little bit of this industry, are you seeing lots more competitors crop up? Is it becoming more competitive?
Yes, definitely. It's become more competitive. We do see that, and this is why it's very important. We're very selective when we take on properties. We don't sign any property that's in Dubai. It has to be a property that's, that we think is going to come on top. And now there's more than 11,000 properties in Dubai that are just up on short term. So for us, I think there's a lot of potential, but you also do need to be very, really selective.
11,000 currently listed in Dubai at the moment.
Yes.
That sounds like a lot. We got, what, about 100,000 hotel rooms, have we? Something like that.
Yes, I think so. And I do think that it's disrupting the hotel industry, short-term rentals. So it's quite different. We're not competing, we're not really competing with hotels, but I would say more like it's it's a different type of experience for the guests that are staying. We do see that we have lots of corporate clients, so I don't think hotels would have clients that are staying for 4 months or 5 months. That is something that we welcome and we focus on as well.
With property prices low historically at the moment, are you seeing people bring investment properties to you? Are you seeing a spike in buying an interest?
Yes, definitely. So now because property prices have dropped, people want to take advantage of this high yield. So, and this is something that we also provide. So if someone, if we have an investor that's asking me, let me know if this building is, is good for short-term rental. What we do is we can go inspect the property and I could let him know like how much I think that they could generate in a yield, like not just revenue per year, but we can tell them like how much we think this property can generate in yield at the end of the year.
Do we see seasonality in the Airbnb business? Are people's property filled for 7 or 8 months of the year and empty for four?
So it's not empty for four. We have a different strategy. What we do is in summer, we rent it out long term. So it's called really midterm. So we have the summer months are filled. We count summer months from Ramadan until September. So until the end of September. And then what we do is just we rent it out for corporate clients in this time period.
So I've got a million dirhams here on the table and I'm coming to you saying, Reem, where do I put my million dirhams in Dubai? What do I buy today to get the most bang for my buck?
We get asked this question so many times and I would advise you to go to DIFC or downtown. Downtown is always going to, there's always demand downtown. And it's also close to DIFC, so we get corporate clients, you get tourism as well. And DIFC is close to downtown, so these two, like one of these two options would be a great opportunity. We know a lot of, you know, buildings there, studio apartments, some one beds that are worth about 1 million, so we can definitely give you advice
on that. What's the sweet spot? Do I want a studio or one bed, or is the demand for three beds or even villas?
So there's a really high demand. Just now, it's been increasing. It's bigger apartments, 3 and 4 bedrooms. It's a niche here in Dubai for travelers,
bigger families
in the GCC. Exactly. There's lots of families that want to come here. They don't want to stay in hotels. They want to stay in luxury apartments that are large luxurious apartments. So another thing would be one beds that fit about 4 people. That's also, we see a very high yield there.
You've got to be getting on quite well. We've got 4 people in one bed.
Thanks very much for joining us. Reem Al-Khatib is Managing Director at Guest Ready, the Airbnb peer-to-peer staying management platform.
Thanks a lot.
Dubai Eye 103.8 presents an array of independent expert opinions and does not advise one particular view. Always seek independent legal advice which considers your own personal circumstances. The Business Breakfast Nightcap.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
A very good evening. I'm Richard Dean and you're listening to The Business Breakfast Nightcap. On holiday.
Staycation rather than awaycation, or at least acting as a travel guide here in Dubai. We've been asking you, what's your secret sauce for tourists? Where do you take them? Somewhere maybe off the hidden track, somewhere a little bit different for a great view or a taste of real Dubai. What do you do when you're rolling out the red carpet?
Well, I take them across the border. I take them to Sharjah.
I take them out.
Exactly. Take them out. There's lots of great places in Dubai. But there's lots of places in Sharjah that people just don't see. So the heart of Sharjah area down by the port is beautiful. It's a little bit like Bastakir in Dubai in that it's old buildings that have been renovated and restored. There's also a beautiful art museum down there as well. But the real place that I love taking people is out in the desert in Sharjah to Mliha. This is the archaeological centre there. There's a 5,000-year-old Bronze Age burial ground. There's lots of the phalange system, the old irrigation system, would you call them, tunnels, drainage channels down there. Lots of caves as well that you can go walking around and walking into. There's a beautiful, nice new visitor centre. It's small but perfectly formed. It's won all kinds of architectural awards. And up there is a wonderful place to go, and you really do feel you're out in the middle of nowhere. And it's only about an hour's drive from Dubai, but it's far enough to give that real sense of being in the middle of nowhere, but not so far that it takes you an age to get there. It's probably more for the winter months than the summer months, because it can be a bit hot up there.
We're having a number of messages come in. Naveen goes to the Razzlecaw Bird Sanctuary.
Oh, lovely. Good, good, good. Share some photos with us if you can.
Adam says a sunset walk at Al Qudra Lakes is what he does to show off. I do a nice line in what I think of as neon night walks myself, taking people around the Karama Electronics Souk or around the sort of the fabric streets of old Satwa at night when, you know, all the neons lit up and there's the hustle and bustle of people doing things in the cooler of the evening. It's quite atmospheric. Ian's been in touch. I don't think we're going to give him any points for taking people off the beaten track, but he's absolutely right in terms of it being a bit of a Dubai staple. This is where he takes his visitors.
We always take them to Ravi's, which is the best authentic restaurant in town. Can't be beaten.
But Ian, do you go to old Ravi's or do you go to new Ravi's in Bir Dubai? That's the question.
Well, Ravi's in Satwa. I'm looking at the TripAdvisor reviews. It's had more than 1,000 reviews. It's rated 327 out of the 10,500 restaurants in Dubai. So you're definitely not alone in liking that one. As for the one in Bir Dubai, I'll get that for you in a second.
Hakim's been in touch. This is his recommendation of what to do with your out-of-town visitors.
I make it a point every time I have guests from abroad, take them to the Uptown Lodge in Jumeirah Beach Hotel. You see, because if you go up and you go out on the terrace, you have this amazing view of the whole of Dubai, especially in the night with all the lights on. And then you have an amazing view also of Burj Al Arab. And on there, they discover how great Dubai is. So that's my secret place that I take them to.
I had two visitors in my flat while I was away. I wasn't here, but they were visiting with me in my absence.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So three visitors, because there was also a one-year-old child with them. And, you know, I've stocked the fridge up with nice things and left them a box of batil dates on the table and a list of things to do. I mean, I knew what the temperature was going to be like. I left them a car and car keys as well. What do you think I put at the top of the list as something to do?
Car park in Deira.
Ski slope in Mall of the Emirates. Small child in a ski suit. Great for photos. Never fails.
That's not bad.
Everyone loves the I went to Dubai and we went skiing story.
Penguins. Yeah, tick the box.
Chris Lund of Colliers International has been in our studio. He looks after hotels for them. That's the area that he focuses his expertise on. So we figured he'd be a good guy to have a hidden gem tourist-wise in Dubai.
So my hidden gem is actually something very simple, but it's driving through Zabil area because you can often see peacocks and it's such a green and beautiful area.
A lot of people coming out with small and tiny beaches. El Mamza over the border. I haven't thought of, is El Mamza technically Sharjah or Dubai?
No, it's Dubai. It feels like Sharjah, but it's
Dubai. Just before you get there, isn't it? I haven't been there in years and years and years. Someone else saying the beach near the Nikki Beach Hotel, not the club, they say, but the actual little beach there is sort of older and undeveloped and feels a bit Dubai 1980s. Oh, Richard, I didn't know you cared.
That's Chinese pop star Renny Chen. The song is Jing Fu Dohang, which means navigate love, and it is a popular song played at Chinese weddings. Why are we talking about that? Because Chinese weddings, big driver of Chinese tourism to Dubai, and the latest figures show that tourist numbers to Dubai increased by 3%. In the first half of this year. Now, some of the traditional source markets are actually fading a little bit. There was a reduction in the number of visitors from India, also a drop off in the number of visitors from the UK. Currency is playing a big part of that. Sterling is weak, the rupee relatively weak against the dirham at the moment, but Chinese tourists, an 11% increase. Now, I was at a big event in Dubai about six, 8 weeks ago called Hala China. organised by Miras and Dubai Holding, two of the big companies here in Dubai, to boost links with China, trade, economics, that kind of thing. And there's a lot being done to tempt Chinese people to get married here in Dubai. It's already happening. In March, there was a mass wedding up at Al Qudra. We just heard someone mention the Al Qudra lakes there. Two of them, and they're man-made lakes, have been created in the shape of love hearts. Mm. And that is very popular with Chinese tourists, because if you get a drone to do aerial photography, you can see very clearly what are called the love lakes. It was a popular wedding, as well as the Chinese newlyweds. Sheikh Mohammed turned up, Bin Rashid. You can see there's a picture of him looking in the national newspaper. White Mercedes G-Wagon, number plate, Dubai 1. And His Highness Sheikh Mohammed is in the passenger seat. And this is all part of the drive to boost tourism. This was kind of baby steps in March this year. But I was at the event at the Burj Al Arab about 6 weeks ago, and an agreement was signed to bring loads more Chinese, not just honeymooners, but people to actually have their wedding and also have the honeymoon here in Dubai. So that is going to accelerate massively over the coming years. And we've been speaking to a number of Chinese visitors at the moment. Joanna is our colleague from Dragon Radio, our sister station, our Mandarin language station. She's been talking to a number of people in China on WeChat about why they like Dubai.
Firstly, it has many famous tourist attractions. For example, it has the tallest building in the world. It has the biggest mall. I mean, Chinese people love shopping. And secondly, it has so many luxurious hotels, so many fancy spas, and the service is great. And what's more, the landscape in Dubai is spectacular. I mean, it's a place where the sea meets the desert, which means we can have a lot of different experiences during one trip.
Dubai is a very Chinese-friendly city. When you go to Dubai Mall, you even can see the signposts written in Chinese. This city is so inclusive that Chinese tourists feel that they are welcome. Second, I think there are so many world records in Dubai. Chinese tourists want to see the tallest building in the world, the most luxury hotel, the world's biggest shopping mall. Seeing is believing.
The currency exchanges in China, now we don't use cash anymore. We are using Alipay or WeChat. So normally the Chinese people will never bring any cash in the pocket. So we just need to bring the phone. So even the phone switched off, we can easily find out the band. So any shops or on the streets, it's quite easy.
That's Chinese tourists giving their views on why Dubai is attractive. Thanks to Joanna Liu, our colleague from Dubai Dragon Radio, for putting that together.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Good evening. You're listening to The Business Breakfast Nightcap. I'm Richard Dean.
Should we all be a little bit worried about what's happening in the US? It has been a scary weekend in the business pages, with warnings about inverted yield curves and speculation about negative interest rates. Having a look at the Financial Times at the moment, the headline, Markets Yield to Recession Fears. At the end of this week, of course, Fed decision makers will meet at Jackson Hole. We have invited economist Khatija Hagen to the studio to explain to us what's going on, what it all means, and whether or not the US could be headed for a recession. Khatija, thanks for joining us. Let's start with the inverted yield curve. I made Richard put his economics masters to good use at the end of last week to explain what the yield curve actually was, the fact that long-term government bonds are now paying out more than short-term.
No.
Less than short-term. You can tell which one of us has got an economics master's degree and which doesn't. Not just in the US, but also in the UK as well, and that movement's predicted every US recession since World War II. How concerned should we be about the inverted yield curve?
We should be concerned because, as you say, for the last 65 years, it's been a pretty good indicator or precursor of a recession. Generally, when the yield curve is inverted, it's on average 18 months to 2 years before the US economy has gone into a recession. But I also think it's important to recognize that markets now are incredibly volatile, and sometimes they can overshoot. So if the curve inverts for, you know, a couple of days or a week, it may not mean that much. But if it remains inverted for an extended length of time, then clearly it's signaling real concern about what's going on in the economy. And in this case, it's not so much the US economy that's concerning investors. It's actually the global economy. And because we're in such an interconnected world, what happens in China, what happens in Europe, what happens in the rest of the world is going to have an impact on the US ultimately. And that's what's really being reflected in this inverted yield curve, in my opinion. So I think what happened last week was we had particularly weak data from China. We had especially weak data from Germany. We had effectively a contraction in German GDP in the second quarter. We had a contraction in the UK economy in the second quarter. So all of these concerns about slowing global growth, which ultimately have come about because of the trade issues, are now starting to weigh on sentiment about what's going to happen in the US over the next 18 months to 2 years. And again, I think it's important to recognize that next year in the US is an election year. And so as an incumbent president, you don't want to go into an election with your economy in recession. So my feeling is that a lot can happen over the next 18 months. It's, you know, if the US economy starts to deteriorate, at the moment it's looking pretty solid. We've got growth at around 2% in the second quarter. We've still got very robust job growth. We've got record low unemployment. We've got 3% wage growth. And consumer spending is still quite strong. In fact, it surprised on the upside in July. So for the moment, the US economy looks quite solid. But I think if things continue to deteriorate, then it puts the president under a tremendous amount of pressure to do something before he goes into that November 2020 election. So that could mean making a deal with China, even if it's not the deal that he wants. It could also encourage him to perhaps spend a little more, adopt some kind of fiscal stimulus or investment program to try and support growth next year, which may end up averting a recession or at least pushing it down the line.
Which are the most important numbers out of everything you've mentioned there? I mean, you know, we can talk about unemployment being at a 50-year low. We can talk about, you know, what's happening with consumer confidence. As an economist, which are the bellwethers for you?
The interest rates are important. And I think because when the market looks to price bonds, they're looking at everything. So it's kind of, you know, the immediate reflection of a number of fundamentals. I think from our perspective, the unemployment or the employment data is probably one of the most important indicators because that tells you what consumers are experiencing. So as a household or as a consumer, if you are worried about your job prospects or you're starting to see people being made redundant and you're concerned about your own job security, you're likely to cut back on spending. And consumer spending in the US is the biggest driver of GDP growth at the moment. So we've seen investment from businesses fall off because they're a little bit uncertain about what's going on with the trade issues. So really, the key driver of US growth at the moment is the consumer. And I think one of the risks that we face is that with all the talk about recession being imminent, with all the talk about what the inverted yield curve might mean for the US economy, and the fact that the Fed itself said that they're going to do they've done an insurance rate cut because they're a little bit concerned about the downside risks. Consumers could look at that and think, okay, we've got to cut back on our spending because things might get worse over the next year. And it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy because if consumers stop spending, then that's actually what is most likely to push the US economy into a recession.
And that's what the Fed will be looking at as well, isn't it? The Fed's job notoriously being to take the punch bowl away when the party is getting good. What are you expecting to see come out in terms of rhetoric from Jackson Hole in the Fed meeting in September?
I think I don't know that we're going to see a tremendous amount of change from what was said at the last meeting, where the Fed basically said they're going to do a 25 basis point rate cut as an insurance rate cut because they recognize that the risks around global growth and the trade wars have increased. But they certainly didn't indicate that this was the start of an extensive rate cutting cycle. I think it was described as a mid-cycle cut. And so, you know, my sense is that, you know, Jerome Powell is probably going to, again, reflect the fact that the US economy is actually still in a very strong position. It's not really the kind of data, we're not seeing the kind of data that suggests to us that the Fed needs to go aggressively into an easing cycle. And the other point I would stress is that the factors which are weighing on growth are not interest rate related. It's not high interest rates which are slowing growth. So cutting interest rates isn't necessarily going to fix the problem. The thing that's weighing on growth is the trade uncertainty and the impact of tariffs on Chinese growth, on European growth, on Japanese growth, etc. So really what needs to happen is some kind of resolution on those issues, on the trade issues, and perhaps governments coming out and spending more in terms of fiscal policy to boost investment in their own economies and drive growth. Lower interest rates, I don't think, are going to be as effective now as they might have been 10 years ago when we were starting from a much higher place in terms of the rate cutting cycle.
So we've got 2 minutes left with you, Khatija. What does it all mean for us here in Dubai?
So lower interest rates are good for us. We've had an economy that's been slowing for the last 2 or 3 years as interest rates have gone up because the US economy has been doing so well. So we've kind of had the worst of both worlds. So I think from our perspective, borrowing costs should come down, particularly if the Fed does ease. Again, we are expecting another 25 basis points rate cut before the end of the year. The market is pricing in 50 before the end of the year. So that certainly is good news for households and those who have mortgages.
Quick word on our top story this morning, Khatija, which is the tourism numbers that are out, 3% increase in visitors to Dubai in the first half of this year. What do you make of that?
It's a decent increase, but it's a little bit slower than what we've seen over sort of the 2014 to 2016 period. And I think, again, that the strength of the dollar has had a negative impact on tourism here. It's made it Dubai a more expensive place to visit, particularly for those visitors from emerging markets who've seen their currencies depreciate against the dollar, whereas, you know, our currency hasn't. So I think going forward, again, lower interest rates should ultimately mean a cheaper dollar, which would then provide another boost to services in Dubai, including tourism.
Khatija Haque of Emirates NBD, thank you very much for joining us and sharing your economic insights.
You're very welcome.
That's it for the Business Breakfast Nightcap. We're back tomorrow morning from 6 a.m. with the Business Breakfast Breakfast.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.